Hi, Tobias Carlisle here. I've launched a new firm called Acquirers Funds. We implement the Acquirers Multiple in a highly liquid, tax-efficient, and capital-efficient way. If you'd like to learn more, go to acquirersfunds.com. One more time. Hi, I'm Tobias Carlisle. This is the Acquirers Podcast. My special guest today is Ben Eifert. He's a Stanford undergrad, Cal PhD. We're going to talk about his firm, Quantitative Volatility Research, right after this.
Tobias Carlisle is the founder and principal of Acquirers Funds. For regulatory reasons, he will not discuss any of the Acquirers Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquirers Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquirersfunds.com.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm well, Toby. Great to talk to you. It's been a while.
Likewise. We were introduced by Chris Cole a number of years ago, and I think that that's likely because you're a volatility guy, just like Chris, but you have a slightly different approach to Chris's. So where Chris is crisis alpha, you're not offering one single thing. You're prepared to, you'll hedge for some clients, you'll offer alpha for others. Is that a fair description of QVR?
Yeah, I think, you know, the way that the world has evolved now versus, say, 10 or 15 years ago, the institutional allocator community is a lot more sophisticated, has a lot more involvement in a wider variety of types of strategies and types of instruments and types of securities. And I think the types of folks that we talk to, you know, they know what's in their portfolios, they know what risk factors they think they're exposed to, they have some idea. What they're really looking for isn't just someone to manage some more of their money, it's, you know, what can I put in my portfolio that makes it a better portfolio from an overall risk-reward perspective, right? And depending on the allocator, that might be any number of different things. And I think our idea is really, how can we bring our skill set and our infrastructure in the options and volatility markets to bear to solve the types of problems that institutional allocators have? And so, you know, I think one major area that we've always been involved in is different types of relative value or absolute return trading in that space. But that we also speak with a lot of folks about more tail risk hedging types of needs. And with other folks about more alternative beta, if you want to use that loaded term, or, you know, yield generation types of needs for folks that need to invest and make some money. So there's, I think, a wide variety of types of things that that we do.
So you could be approached with a question as open-ended as, what can you do for us? Or do they come to you and say, we have this very specific need to hedge this problem, how would we do it with volatility?
Yeah, it can be anywhere along that spectrum. I mean, often the way, you know, a conversation might go is you'll get introduced to a pension fund manager, for example, that, you know, is looking at the world and thinking, gosh, you know what, we're long a whole lot of equities and we have to be, and that's, you know, what makes sense, but I'm pretty worried about the medium term outlook for X, Y, and Z reasons. Gosh, I remember back in 2008 when my firm had to, you know, fire sell equities with S&P 650 because we didn't have the cash to pay benefits. So what can I do in the current market environment that doesn't cost me too much, that will give me some protection against that type of environment? You know, here's what my portfolio looks like. It has this kind of global, you know, asset allocation characteristics. So that might be one type of way that a conversation might evolve.
And when you're expressing those trades for them, you're doing it purely through options, or are you doing that options and futures? How does the trade get expressed in practical terms?
Yeah, so depends on what type of exposure, but often it'll be options. We might, for relatively simple tail risk hedging type of trades, which we were going along that example, you might not need futures. Usually futures would be something more involved in dynamic hedging of an option position, like if you want, but for a simple static tail risk allocation, you might not need that. So there might be some listed equity options. There might be, depending on, again, the set of needs, there might be listed options in other asset classes, like, you know, treasury bond futures, for example, or treasury bond options. There might, in some cases, be some over-the-counter derivatives that meet other different kinds of needs, things called variance swaps, for example, that are just a pure play exposure to volatility and tail risk.
And you find that there's sufficient liquidity in the options, in listed options, to even in single names to put those trades on?
So liquidity in, I would make a couple of distinctions of what we mean. So on primarily what we do, we're more index focused than we are single name focused. I think typically the types of risks that a large institution is worried about from a tail risk perspective in particular, you know, are usually broad macro events. They're not usually specifically trying to hedge individual equity exposures that they have, or if they do, that's, you know, again, just a very specific thing. So we tend to live more in index, region, sector type of exposures. Liquidity in general in the option markets, I think in index has, in our view, certainly volumes have increased and increased and increased very steadily every year for the last, you know, many years in index, whereas that wouldn't be the case really in single name options. I think single name option volumes have somewhat stagnated, or at least grown not nearly as quickly as index. And there's a variety of reasons for that.
Well, what are those reasons?
So one reason I think is just that when you are the primary market makers in options are going to be the bank, the broker dealers, and also the major electronic option market makers like Citadel and Walleye and various other folks. Those folks are trying to solve a pretty specific risk management problem when they're doing business, right? Which is they want to do lots of volume with some edge in that they're, you know, making bids and offers, and people are paying them some spread that covers some of the risk that they get into a position that moves against them. In single names, the toxicity risk of flow is higher, right? Because people lift you on those nickel calls on, you know, some funny company right before earnings. And just the asymmetry of information is a much worse problem for a dealer. I would say 10 or 15 years ago, banks and other organizations involved in market making were just making money hand over fist in everything that they were doing. And when things are going that well, you can be aggressive across a variety of business lines that maybe aren't as profitable for you and just as part of an overall business, right? So I think that's why, banks were more aggressive, say, even in 2008 or, 2007 on some single name related things. You know, whereas index, you don't have nearly the same asymmetric information problem, right? S&P options, you know, for the most part, there really aren't events and special situations of a very, very major variety. Obviously, there's Fed releases, and there's certain kinds of discrete moments when information becomes available that someone might have gotten a hold of. But it's just a much smaller adverse selection problem for market makers. So I think that's what's really bifurcated the liquidity there.
I think since the 2007-9 crash, a lot of folks have been very nervous about the market. For some reason, that seems to have lingered a lot longer than the dot-com crash. And so it's my impression that it's been expensive to hedge for much of the last decade. How can you hedge more cheaply, or how can you put that crisis alpha tail hedge on and do it in a more cost-effective way?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a couple of things. Generally, options and volatility and tail risk became extremely expensive in the immediate wake of the crisis, as you point out. Right? Unfortunately, the behavioral reality of these things is that the most demand for hedging happens after the event that you should have hedged, right? And we can, all the reasons why that is better than I do. So from 2009, 10, 11, 12, there was a persistent, very high risk premium in general across the options landscape, especially in index, which again was the go-to hedge. If you're nervous, you go buy S&P options. And that was driven by, again, broad-based demand for hedging. Lots of big institutional investors put, you know, systematic tail risk hedging programs in place where they just said, we're willing to burn, you know, 1% a year or 2% a year as a hedge budget to go try to protect the downside. The cumulative effect, of course, of everybody going and buying protection and everybody being scared to sell it is that it becomes way too expensive, right? So a lot of those programs lost money very quickly for several years, and you know, obviously their value didn't turn out to be good values for the folks that were running them. And you started to see a lot of those large-scale institutional hedging programs start to die off, say 2013, 2014, 2015. Many of those same institutions then over time replaced those programs, not explicitly, but with option selling programs for yield generation, typically different types of options, more towards the front of the short-term options and things. But in general, there's been much, much less demand for protection of portfolios over the last, call it 5 years, than there was in the 5 years after the crisis. So there's to some extent this significant crisis hangover, as you point out. I think that in option markets anyway, that's, I would argue, mostly gone away. Generally speaking, you always expect there to be some risk premium in option markets, the same way there are in any markets, right? Unless things are incredibly distorted, you should have a positive expected return on equities, and on credit, you should have a negative, you know, expected return on buying volatility and hedges. And that's still certainly true, but we think much, much less than it was for a time. Now, that said, you know, to more specifically, just to your point, where do you find relatively affordable tail risk protection? Because, of course, all prices aren't created equal. The first question you have to ask yourself is, well, if it's going to be relatively inexpensive, you have to find somebody who's selling it to you, right? Because if you're having to pay some, you know, if you're having to go out and pay someone to manufacture it at, you know, a high cost themselves, it's going to be different. And so one major source of supply of tail protection that's available in the post 2008 environment, and particularly the last 5 years. So if you think of retail structured product investors, it's a concept that for U.S. investors isn't as, you know, top of mind, because I think typical U.S. investors and retail investors, they buy stocks and they buy bonds, and now they buy ETFs and mutual funds and so forth. But globally, especially in Europe and Asia, retail investors predominantly do other types of things. They go to their local branch of BNP Paribas and they buy a structured note that might be a 4-year note that gives them an 8% or 10% coupon. In exchange for in the current environment, typically in exchange for taking some equity market downside risk. So actually, back up a second. In the old days, the more typical thing that the European folks used to buy were principal protected notes. So think of, in a world where interest rates are 5% or 6%, you as a bank can offer to a customer a principal protected investment in equities, say in just an index, for example. By taking their $100, locking it up for 4 or 5 years, buying them some long-term call options, and then buying them some zero coupon bonds, enough to give them their money back if stocks go down, right? And that's called a principal protected note. Those type of investments were very popular for a long time. That works when interest rates are sufficient to buy a zero coupon bond and make that all work out, right? What replaced that in the wake of 2008, slowly as interest rates went down and stayed down and long-term interest rates went down, so you couldn't really generate that kind of yield anymore, was put selling types of structures, right? So you can't get yield by buying it, you know, by taking interest rate exposure, you have to get yield by selling puts. And so the typical structures involved in that marketplace now might be the investor, again, puts up $100, they get a 10% coupon yield every year, unless at some point the equity market that's referenced in the note is down 30%, upon which the investor just gets put into those equities at that price, right? So they take you know, some bad left tail equity risk in exchange for getting a coupon on the upside. In doing that, the retail investor who's buying that note is selling, effectively selling long-term, deep, out-of-the-money tail protection, and the bank is buying it. And then the bank isn't in the business of just holding on to that. The bank then recycles that into the markets through through typically selling down long-term downside puts as a hedge. And so those are very big businesses globally, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of issuance of those types of products a year that effectively involve retail investors selling you tail risk insurance on the S&P, on the Euro stocks, on the Nikkei, on the HSCEI. So the major big global indices are all very popular, and there's all kinds of structures and products, right? But that kind of gives you an answer to the question, well, gosh, who's going to sell me some nice tail protection?
So basically the investors in Japan, Japanese investors first, I guess, and then more recently, European investors are starved for yield. And the way that they are provided with that yield, you sell some puts out far enough that you hope that they're not struck. And then you get this yield in the interim. Are the Japanese notes, are they called Yuridashi notes? Is that the...
Yeah, so Yuridashi notes are the typical name in Japan. These products are also very popular in Korea. There's a huge market in Korea that's linked to all manner of other global indices. And then European investors as well. But yeah, I think the Japanese structured note market in the Yuridashis is one of the oldest and best developed. And similarly, to your point, Japanese rates have been low for a long time, actually, right? So they had Japan had its major bubble and then bust in the early 90s, and it has really been in sort of a stagnation, deflation environment ever since. And so that's provided the impetus for the development of these markets.
I have two thoughts about that. One is that do you think that the Japanese buyers of these notes understand the risk that the note carries with it?
I think typically they understand the basic notion that if, you know, the markets are very bad, they're going to lose some money. These notes are often quite complex, actually. And I think the complexities of the notes are often probably lost. I mean, in many cases, for example, the notes will be linked not just to one index, but like to the worst performing of a basket of three indices. And they might also have some features about how the notes get called back to the issuer if the market's up a certain amount. And, you know, they turn into actually very complicated derivative products that you need, you know, fancy quants to think about how to price and so forth. Really, you know, I think generally my view would be that retail investors probably would be better served trying to do simpler things that they understood a bit better. But the basic allure is that it's hard to find anything that's going to give you an optical 8 or 10% yield, you know, anywhere in the world, right? And I think people compare that type of product to the type of really gnarly credit you'd have to buy these days to get an 8 or 10% yield, and they say, "God, this seems better, right? It's the, you know, it's large cap equity risk. It's not, you know, some near bankrupt company."
I don't mind it behaviorally, though. If you're forced to buy down 30%, it's probably not a bad place to be buying equities. So that's the tail hedging, and that's the source of the. That's where you can at least find some liquidity and you can find some better pricing. On the alpha side, what sort of strategies do you implement to try and generate returns?
So everything, I think, starts from the same basic thought process, which is, you know, derivatives markets exist not because there are guys like us who, you know, want to go find some, you know, some sneaky trades to do to try to generate some alpha. Derivatives markets exist because there are end users of derivatives that are trying to achieve some objective, right? And most of those, so for example, you know, those retail investors selling those, buying structured products and effectively selling puts are an example of that. They're an end user of derivatives. Pension funds who are buying, you know, downside protection to hedge are an end user of derivatives. And these days, pension funds who are selling short-term options, for example, in the context of call overwriting, overwriting calls over their existing equity portfolio are end users of derivatives. So an absolute return investment process in derivatives would typically just start with asking the question, you know, where are there big imbalances in the market, either temporary or relatively persistent, where some end user is doing some, or some end user or some large group of end users are doing something in very big size, you know, because it achieves one of their objectives, but that's, you know, too large relative to the market, or that's congesting a particular part of the market. And so an example in the last several years is I started to allude to call overwriting and cash secured put selling, typically relatively short dated in index options, has become very, very popular among large institutional investors. These types of strategies. So, for example, you take a, you know, $100 billion pension fund that has $60 billion of equity exposure. That investor is going to say, look, if stocks are up 30% this year, I'm going to be doing great. What can I do that path diversifies me a bit so that if stocks are flat, I do a little bit better? Well, one thing I could do is I own $60 billion of equities. Maybe I sell $10 billion of call options against those equities, right? So then that investor will do slightly less well if the market goes up 30%, but look, he's going to be fine. If the market's flat, he's probably going to harvest some yield from selling those options.
Simplify. So they're basically selling some strike above 30 mm-hmm. on the call, so that on the basis that 30% is a great year for anybody. Anything above that's just being greedy. We're much more likely to have returns below that, so we can get some yield by selling those strikes that are out further. Is that the approach?
Yeah, that's the basic idea. And it typically wouldn't be, you know, 1 year, 30%, you know, upside strikes. Typically, it would be every month they might sell, you know, $10 billion of, you know, 2 or 3% out of the money strikes, but then do that every month, you know, roll that type of position every month. So, you know, some months are going to be flat months and they'll just collect the premium that they sold. You know, some months are going to be up 5% and then they'll lose a bit of money on that particular month on the options that they sold. Some months will be down months in the equity market and they'll make a little money. And their bet is that over the course of a year, selling those modestly out of the money strikes every month, they're going to harvest some, they're going to net collect some premium, or at least, you know, if the market is up huge, they will have given back some money on that program, but their underlying equity exposure is very large, much larger typically than they're overwriting. So it's a way to, you know, transfer some returns from a scenario path where the market's up a lot to a scenario path where the market's flat and choppy, or maybe even down small or something like that. So these types of programs are very popular. And also, if you're to look at a 30-year back test of the performance of these types of strategies, they look very, very good, largely because short-term options for a long time were really quite expensive. I think our view is that what you've then seen happen is these strategies to grow in popularity to such an extent, you know, now a pretty significant portion of the large-scale institutional investor community has some type of call overwriting program. For example, it might be 40% of pensions, and the size of those. And most folks are doing something very, very similar. So typically, they'll sell, you know, relatively near the money, slightly upside, 1 month options. So everybody's doing the same thing in very big size. And what that typically does is it changes, you know, the price and changes the forward-looking expected performance relative to that 30-year back test that, you know, that you did in the first place. And so what folks like us, when we're looking at absolute return strategies, we think, okay, most likely we are supposed to actually be buyers of that oversold part of the options market. And we're probably supposed to think about what else we can sell against it to hedge, so that we have a hedged position where we're buying something cheap and selling something expensive. And then you have to go do a bunch of work and figure out, well, how would you actually do that and what would make the most sense and what type of a portfolio are you going to have, and so forth. But that the starting point is almost always, you know, where is there some kind of dynamic in the market that's involving, you know, some large scale behavior by end users of derivatives that's making something too cheap or something too expensive. And then how do you structure a strategy around that?
How are you making the assessment that it's too cheap or too expensive?
So with options, typically what you're looking at, right, is when you trade relatively short-term options, those options, you can normalize their price in some sense into what we call an implied volatility, right? Because as we typically, and volatility traders and market makers don't retain directional exposure to options, we would always, so if we were to buy a call option, we would sell equity against it to be neutral to the equity market. If you were to compare that implied volatility or normalized price, the level of volatility that would justify the current dollar market price of options to expectations of the actual realized volatility that you're going to see in the market, that tells you something about how cheap or expensive those options are. If you were to look 10, 20, 30 years ago, typical levels of implied volatility for short-term options were much higher relative to the likely level of realized volatility that was going to occur. So that premium was much higher than it is in the last several years.
And that's why the end users have put those trades on, because they're trying to harvest that. And now that that's been suppressed, it creates an opportunity for you. So you're trying not to be directional to the equity. Mm-hmm. Are you trying to be neutral to the volatility, or are you somewhat directional to the volatility?
We always have some type of volatility exposure, but we're not, in this case, we're not only in an absolute return mandate anyway. We're not only buying those options and then, you know, hoping for volatility to emerge. What we're doing is looking elsewhere for example, slightly longer term options where there's more of a balance between buying and selling and supply and demand, and where the profitability is driven also by things like what is the term structure of implied volatility look like? Is it much higher for somewhat longer term options, and how does that work? And being able to structure a portfolio with both shorter term and longer term options.
Do those occur because there's some event? There's some political event? So sometimes there's volatility around presidential elections, or there's volatility around macroeconomic events globally. Is that what creates the unusual shapes in the term structure?
So there is event pricing in the term structure. So you'll always notice, the options expiring immediately after some well-defined known catalyst, like a Fed meeting, for example, will trade at some premium. But in general, the shape of the level of implied volatility for options at different with different amount of time to maturity and a different strike price, so downside puts versus upside calls, really is all determined by supply and demand. So who's buying what and who's selling what. Right? So typically when markets are relatively quiet and volatility is low, usually the term structure of implied volatility, which just means what is the level of implied volatility for, 1 month options, 2 month options, 3 month options, what is the shape of that relationship? Typically it's upward sloping. Because the notion is, look, I mean, if things are quiet right now, in a year or two, who knows, all kinds of things can happen. And if you're going to sell a 1 year option to someone, you're obviously taking some risk that things change and the world gets, more volatile. And so typically in a quiet environment, that would trade at a premium to a short term option. But supply and demand really is what determines all of those parameters.
So just to step back slightly, you have an undergrad in economics and then your PhD from Cal. What was your PhD in?
It was also in economics, actually.
And then you went and worked in an emerging markets economist for the World Bank.
That's right. Yeah. So I worked for the chief economist of the World Bank, initially mostly focused on sub-Saharan Africa, and then some work on Latin America and India across a variety of different things. But yeah, so emerging markets macro.
So how do you then transition from, I don't imagine there's an enormous amount of math in something like that into something that's heavily math driven. That's an unusual step.
Yeah, and actually, I realize I just got, I think we did the timing slightly wrong. So I worked for the World Bank in between undergraduate and grad school. And
Gotcha.
so in grad school, I did some emerging markets macro work, and actually my thesis was in that area, but over time started working more and more on finance. And graduate school in a technical discipline is like anything else. You can do a wide variety of different types of things and acquire a wide variety of different types of skills. And in my case, applied statistics and applied math is sort of the core of it. And finance is in the or quantitative finance is sort of a field of that. So you learn how to write code, and you learn how to program computers, and you learn how to do statistics and so forth. And you get a job, and you learn what you got to do. So yeah, from there I went to the I worked actually at a hedge fund for a while I was in grad school, but my first real job was on the Wells Fargo prop desk after grad school.
And what were you doing on the desk?
So I was a quant. I was the main quant, and then I hired a few people and ran a small quant team on the at Wells Fargo. And then we did that business spun out and became a hedge fund. Eventually, I started picking up some responsibility for the for derivatives trades that were outside the core wheelhouse of the business. So that business was primarily focused on corporate securities, so things like convertible bond arbitrage, capital structure arbitrage, trading, secured debt versus unsecured debt. I started doing some of the, for example, currency derivatives, so more macro-oriented volatility trading, primarily from a portfolio hedging perspective initially, and then we did build out more of a pure play derivatives relative value volatility trading piece of that business subsequently.
And you were a lecturer at Haas, at Berkeley Haas at some stage. They have a quant finance school. Is that what you were doing there?
Yeah, so they have a master's in financial engineering program, which is a great program. I taught in that program, as part of graduate school for
Right.
several years, and then subsequently, at least for a few years. I'm not. Re it's a big. It's too bad. It's a very tough time. Competition for time. Teaching is great, and I really enjoy it. And it is actually useful from a business perspective because, there's not really a better way to recruit than to have continued direct exposure to students, as opposed to, you interview somebody a few times, and you're primarily often testing whether they're good at interviewing. But it's a big time. It is a big time demand. So I'm not currently teaching.
And then you launched QVR in 2016.
Would have been 2016. I was working on it, so I was on garden leave all of 2016 and building a lot of the core infrastructure. But then we did launch the business in 2017.
And your clients tend to be large institutions for the most part who approach you with a specific problem, and it could be hedging or it could be alpha generation. Can we talk a little bit more about I heard your conversation with Corey. You were discussing some interesting one interesting trade anyway, that was trading volatility of energy companies in large cap versus small cap. Can you just walk us through that?
Sure. So I think, this is an absolute return trade example, the type of thing that would come up in the context of some of our strategy sleeves in relative value trading. So I think the example that I gave was, there are obviously many participants in ETF option markets. One major use case, I think I gave the example again of overwriting, right? So I think I gave the example of what happens when there's a large fund manager who, for example, owns a lot of equities in small cap energy and decides to do some large scale overwriting, sell a whole bunch of call options. Typically, what we would see is we would see the prices of options on those small cap energy names, or I think I'd maybe give the example of the ETF, maybe XOP, an ENP ETF. See those prices fall significantly relative to where they were previously, and a relative also to the prices of options on large cap energy names or XLE, for example. And you'd probably also see that nothing really appeared to change in the dynamics of realized volatility in those sectors. It wasn't that suddenly, you know, the XLE names, the large cap names, became a lot more volatile relative to the small cap names. And, you know, we might see direct evidence that those trades happen. Probably you would see those if they were done and listed, you'd probably actually see the transactions occur and you'd, you know, hear that they occurred. And typically, you know, we have a variety of models for thinking about this. But one thing we might end up doing is buying those options on the small cap energy names that were heavily sold by the overwriter down to a significantly cheaper price. And we might hedge by selling the options on the large cap names and then be in a relative value trade position. That, again, is the result of a more temporary point in time demand. And by end users, in this case, an owner of the equities who was willing to sell off the upside above some point and did it in such large size that he depressed the relative price.
So it's somewhat opportunistic when you're finding these trades. How do you screen for them, or how do you hunt for them?
I mean, that type of thing where it would be something where, you know, you're as a business in this space, right? You obviously have the full data history on all of these types of things, where are the options on all the different major liquid sectors trading, and you have models that very quickly observe the price changes and, you know, all the other signals associated with that, and would be highlighting that to you, right? So it's opportunistic in a sense, but really you could manage that type of a strategy nearly completely systematically if you so chose, in that you're monitoring many different relationships like that continually and have signals that are triggering when significant changes in price happen that don't have any clear justification in underlying price dynamics.
So that's my next question. Is it enough that the trade seems to you to be mispriced, or do you then need to find out, do you need to understand why?
So we like to understand why. At a minimum, we like to validate to ourselves that there is not a really good reason why this price is changing, right? So in derivatives markets, you know, typically large price changes either happen because something underlying structural is changing and the price change is justified, or because there's some large transactions that just there's a big buyer or a big seller and they're changing the price. And we would like to be involved in the latter and not in the former, right? Obviously one example, in that particular example, the thing that you would be worried about if there was some, I mean, in that example, it's hard to think of, but, you know, some fundamental reason why the small cap energy names were going to be really quiet for the next month or something, whether there would be something regulatory. I don't have a great immediate example off the top of my head, but like a similar thing that's, I think, a better example And it gets a bit wonky, but if you think back to Japan in 2012, 2013, remember the Japanese equity market had been, you know, dead for a long time, at very depressed levels and very quiet. And one market price change that people started to notice was that the price of call options, upside call options in the Nikkei, was starting to go up a lot relative to the price of downside put options. So in some sense, you know, people who were buying options were doing so in a very bullish way, for the market, if you want to think of it that way. And, you know, it was the type of thing where if you were just running some historical data analysis through some statistical models and coming up with a judgment thereof, you would have said, gosh, this is a really big price change that we don't really, to an extent that you don't really ever see it before, and this is silly, and you're supposed to do some kind of trade that involves, you know, betting on mean reversion, or selling those call options and buying the put options and doing some kind of hedge. But the key thing to understand, you know, it was, you know, Abe was putting in place a bunch of new large-scale programs involving huge new central bank easing and structural reform, and the marketplace was getting really focused on the possibility that the Japanese economy would be revitalized and the equity market would go on a big tear. And that is, you know, really what you saw was, you know, a violent, highly volatile rally in the Japanese equity market. And if you had just naively looked at market prices going up in these calls and down in these puts and said that this is silly, it's some kind of statistical aberration, you're supposed to trade against that, you know, which some folks did, you really got run over, right? So I think from our perspective, you know, we're always most interested in, again, price dislocations coming from end users and flow. We want to be able to validate from a defensive perspective that there's no, you know, big macro regime change that's driving what appears to be a change in prices. If there is, we probably just don't want to be involved. We might, you know, might have a view on Abenomics or not, but we know that there's smart macro traders who are making those bets, and our job is not to bet against them.
And there was a similar event with Volmageddon in February 2018.
Yeah, I mean, in February 2018, I mean, the lead up to that, of course, was that retail investors largely first discovered VIX products and volatility markets, call it back in 2011, 2012, and I think, again, those markets are somewhat complex. Retail investors really liked buying volatility through those products because it was very easy to do. It became extremely overpriced in that product, and folks didn't really understand why they were losing money, because if I bought a VIX and VIX was 15 and VIX is still 15, why am I losing money? They didn't necessarily understand that they were buying futures, and futures have a term structure and so forth. So after several years of losing money doing this, the retail investment crowd discovered that they could just short the same products instead of buying them. And actually new ETFs were created that did that under the hood and allowed them to just buy an ETF, which was effectively shorting VIX products. And those investments did very well for a period of time, but became too large for the market. And volatility went down and down and down, and the risk premium embedded in those products went down and down and down, and that culminated in Volmageddon, as you said, in February 2018. One market price change that folks observed ahead of that was that options on VIX products, particularly upside call options, were becoming very expensive in the sense of just that, you know, the price was rising, so clearly people were buying them, again, to relatively unusually high levels. But the justification for that was that this possible event of this major short squeeze in the VIX complex and the unwinding of some of those ETNs was looking very plausible and looking potentially like it could happen in a relatively short period of time. And so certainly selling those optically expensive VIX calls would not have worked out, you know, very well for you. And again, so understanding the landscape, understanding the risk characteristics, you know, that are out there in the world is really important, not just seeing a time series chart of some index and thinking it's too high.
Investors seem to have been chastened in the aftermath of XIV failing and so on. But do you see any emerging changes to the volatility term structure, or do you see anything out there that's skewing the market for volatility?
You know, certainly not. I don't see anything equivalent to, you know, the VIX complex in late 2017, early 2018, where you really felt like there was a ticking time bomb to some extent, where you didn't know the timing, but you figured it was highly probable that there would be a bad event at some point. Generally speaking, you know, our view is that there's, again, very heavy selling of short-term index options via call overwriting and put underwriting by large institutions. Probably to the point that's significantly depressed expected returns that those folks think they're getting relative to historical benchmarks. That's not a blow-up risk. That's very different, right? These are large, deep-pocketed institutional investors overwriting calls against some proportion of their equity portfolio, right? So they can underperform their expectations, but there's no sense in which this is some kind of blow-up risk. The only other, you know, there is some risk. We talked a little bit about retail structured products and how there's some supply of tail risk coming out of that. There is some risk in that landscape, just in the sense that those structured products are typically, again, relatively complex. Banks issue them and hedge them, and the hedging of complex products is usually a complicated and error-prone and risky, you know, business. And there are scenarios where the equity market is down 30 or 35% over 3 to 6 months, and that space generates some pretty big unexpected blow-ups for banks. But we saw that to some extent in China in 2015, where if you recall, in summer of 2015, Chinese equities almost doubled over the summer in a big bubble, and there were all of these videos of vegetable peddlers on the street with their laptops, you know, doing their trading. And then those prices subsequently fell about 50%. And it did cause a big squeeze in those longer term options associated with structured products. And there were some big losses in the market. But again, this stuff is, I think, relatively contained to specific pockets of the market that, you know, don't have. None of it is systemic risk or anything of that variety. I think that most of it is, you know, some folks that could lose some money in the wrong scenarios.
What about the structured notes that the Japanese and Europeans are buying? What sort of behavior does that create if they knock in down 35% or wherever they kind of kick in?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I was alluding to. So the trick is that those notes, you know, we talked about the investors effectively selling put options. It's a bit trickier than that. They're technically selling something which is called a knock-in put option, in the sense that really the investors only get put into the stocks once the stocks are down, let's say 30%, for example. And then they're just long stocks and there's no more option associated with that. And what that means is that the banks who are issuing and creating these notes, initially when they issue the note, they'll do some kind of hedging. Typically they'll sell like a long-term out of the money put. But if the market goes all the way down there and those notes start to knock in, the bank still has that put that they're short that they sold, but there's no option anymore that they're long, right? Just the retail, it was converted into a stock exposure. And so that's a tricky type of risk to manage for the banks. What it means is that at some point, as the equity markets go down and down and down, banks suddenly start getting short volatility. They're getting net short options because they used to own a long option, which they sold a vanilla put against, but then they don't have that option anymore. And so that creates some potential short squeeze dynamics, where this is happening to all the banks at more or less the same time, and they're all having to go and buy back, you know, 2-year options, 3-year options, exactly at the wrong time when the market's down 30%. That's the risk.
So on a day-to-day basis, you're just running your models, trying to find something that's slightly mispriced, trying to understand why that is the case, and then trying to find a way to trade that for clients. Is that what happens?
Yeah, I mean, think of there's going to be a variety of types of strategies, right? So in absolute return land, you know, some things that we're doing, the mispricings are slower moving, and the day-to-day work is more about maintaining the risk exposures that you want as the world moves, as prices move around and so forth. And so we're rolling some options from one maturity to another, or taking profits someplace and increasing exposure some other place. Some things, as you mentioned, like in the example of that, the small cap versus large cap energy volatility exposure, that might be something where new mispricings or new seeming mispricings pop up relatively quickly, and we want to try to assess them and see whether we're going to put on a trade or not. But yeah, generally speaking, you know, it's a an investment process that's built on different strategy sleeve building blocks, which each have their own logic and their own infrastructure around them for providing the information that you need to make decisions and make the fine-tuning adjustments to the portfolio on a day-to-day basis. Similarly, a tail risk hedging program is typically more going to be, usually things aren't changing dramatically on a day-to-day basis, right? You have some longer-term oriented exposures. At some point, you might start rolling some of those exposures to longer dated instruments once you've owned them for some number of months or so forth. But the exercise is on a day-to-day basis is typically more incremental.
And are you allowed to trade a PA?
We are allowed to. I'm too busy to be too involved in a PA, but yes, in principle, subject to, you know, the standard restrictions.
Is there an internal hedge fund or an internal way for you to pool your investments?
There's not. In principle, so there are firms that do that. I think our view is it's, you know, it is somewhat tricky running like an internal prop allocation together with client allocations. You can do it, but you have to, of course, worry about all the documentation of and trade splits and allocations and making sure that you're not doing things that you shouldn't be. Our view is that it's not necessarily worth it.
And so how do you invest your own money?
Well, I'm a small business owner, so most of my money is just right there in the business, you know, supporting the activities of what we need. And then the part that's not is very just long term. You know, is sort of how the way you would want your dad to manage his money.
Very vanilla,
very long term oriented, and try not to look too often. Try to rebalance it when you're supposed to.
Oh, that's great. Ben, we're coming up on time. If folks want to get in contact with you, what's the best way to do that?
Sure. You can look at our website, QVRAdvisors.com. I think there's a contact form on there that works. I think my email address is ben@QVRAdvisors.com if anyone wants to reach out to.
And you're on Twitter.
I am on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter. Fair warning, though, I think 95% of my Twitter content is, you know, comments on what savagery my 3.5-year-old son is up to lately, or you know, things of that variety. What music is on in the office? But you're welcome to check it out.
I think there's a good tweet today. It was about whether you're allowed with the broken headphones, whether you could just pump it up.
That's right. Well, yeah, yesterday markets have been very quiet, as you know. And so, you know, the office banter starts to kick up and the distractions start to elevate.
Everybody's gone on vacation.
That's right.
Well, that's great. Thanks very much for spending some time with us, Ben Eifert, QVR.
Absolutely, Toby. It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.